And good afternoon. It is a Thursday, August the 2nd, 2018, 14 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program. Scott Spears along with you for the ride. And as I said earlier, today is the 95th commemoration anniversary of the death of President Warren G. Harding. President Harding died on August the 2nd, 1923. 95 years ago today, August 2nd, 1923. Now, we're going to be joined by his grandson, Jim Blessing, for his only interview here momentarily. But I do want to let you know, tomorrow, coming up, August the 3rd, WWGH reports from the Marion Prison Choir. Now, this is a special you're not going to want to miss. Interviews with choir director Catherine Roma, two inmates and members of the choir, and clips of the choir rehearsing. This will air tomorrow, Friday, August the 3rd, from 6:10 until 7 p.m., and then it will repeat from 9:10 until 10 p.m. Now, before we talk about President Harding, I wanted to give you a little preview of tomorrow's special from the Marion Correctional Facility. Here's a little taste.
You know, I think being here, seeing the creativity, is fascinating because I believe, I don't know that most people know that's going on. So I think there are misconceptions. What do you think the biggest misconception by people is about what goes on?
Just it's a place of this criminal-minded people, and it's not that. We weren't born here. We got stories, backgrounds that shaped and molded our ways of thinking, and now we get in the time to reshape our way of thinking and get that soberness in us. You know what I mean? So, just like we talked about earlier, we just can be a great addition to society, and I think a lot of people, without knowing, without doing any studying, without coming in here, without talking and having conversations with us, can just write us off as just the criminal minded, the downtrodden, the worthless, and so forth. You know, and that's just not the key. It's just not. And I'm gonna say that in general. I'm gonna speak that in general. I've met so many great minds in here, so many people that has really changed, really are remorseful for what they done, what kind of crimes they committed, and they put the effort in every day. Every day. And that's when that integrity comes in. I've seen guys get flopped at the board and still remain the person that they were as far as the improvement that they made after they got flopped at the board. I've seen guys get denied for judicial releases and take it on the chin and say, you know what, I'm just going to keep doing what I was doing better. I'm going to keep learning. I'm going to keep loving on everybody. And that's huge because people can falter under that kind of disappointment and that rejection. But I see a lot of men just hold their head up and keep doing better because the change is real.
Yeah, most definitely. The misconception of all of us actually being criminals, like, we're all convicted of a crime. Like, none of us can deny that. But everyone here isn't a criminal. Some of us are actually victims of circumstance because of traumatic things that we've been through as children or in our young adulthood, situations and circumstances such as poverty that can steer you to a lifestyle that you don't necessarily want to live, or to make a mistake that you didn't want to make, but you feel compelled or pressured based on where you are or who you are to do that. And, you know, a lot of people here, when they come here, get a chance to be who they want to be because, you know, your circumstance before prevented you from doing that. So when you are allowed to flourish in the way that you desire, you become the person that you want to become, and that person is the person who's going back into society. And it would do everybody a justice if they could recognize that, if they could recognize the person and they could recognize what's internally instead of the action. Because most times the action is only one thing. So, you know, when we talk about behavior, when we talk about trauma, when we talk about change and transformation and those things, there are way more people who don't recidivate when they actually get a chance to go through that process. And those people become productive. And like I said, when you Google them and you look at that person, you would never guess that. So, like, you know, that's key. That's vital. That's important.
You talked about that perception. And that's something that must be looked at. Our action especially him and I are first timers. Our action, that one action, shouldn't define who we are. We did something stupid, but we're not stupid. You understand what I'm saying? So it's so much more to us.
Beyond the barricade, is there a world you want to see? Then join in the fight that will give you the right to be free. Do you hear the people sing, singing the songs of angry men? It is the music of the people, who not be slain. Hear the beating of the heart, echo the beating of the drums. There is a life about to start when tomorrow comes.
And again, my special tomorrow, Scott Spears from the Marion County Prison, with the Marion Prison Choir, which you heard performing there. That was a little snippet of the special interviews with choir director Catherine Roma, two inmates, members of the choir, and clips of the choir rehearsing. The full special will air tomorrow, August the 3rd, right here on WWGH Radio, 6:10 to 7 p.m. and 9:10 to 10 p.m. Don't miss that for love nor money. Now, don't miss what we're going to talk about for the next 40 minutes, because we haven't had this gentleman on for a while, but I certainly enjoy having him on, because if anybody has a tie to Marion, it is this gentleman. 95 years ago today, President Warren G. Harding died while in office, August the 2nd, 1923. Today, we are joined by his grandson, the child of the child he had with Nan Britton, Jim Blessing. Jim, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
It's good to talk with you. It's been a while. What's been
new? Yeah, I know. I need that little few-day advance there.
Well, I always appreciate you coming on. Jim, today, the 95th commemoration of the passing of your grandfather, what thoughts go through your mind when you hear that?
It's hard. It's a shame the whole thing ended as it did, and I don't know what you would say. All of it that's happened has been a bonus, so it makes it kind of okay. I felt like I've done something for him and my grandmother and my mom, and I think that that kind of makes up for everything. And we finally got mission and got her some and cleared things up a little bit for everybody.
Jim, here's what I want to do, because we might have some new listeners out there. This did not happen until 2015. Tell people how this all came about, and tell people who your grandmother was.
My grandmother was Nan Britton, and she was actually, the families were friends. Her father was a doctor, and he was friends with Warren, and they lived in the same neighborhood. And as she grew up, as she got older, she kind of developed a crush on him, and it kind of grew and grew. And then after she ended up signing up to help with his election for Senate, and she kind of got more involved with him, and she just had this love for him. And so she used to kind of wait for him and follow him, and, you know, the typical crush thing, you know. So this went on for quite a while, and this is my grandmother I met. This went on for quite a while, and they were aware of it. The families were aware of it. The fathers had even talked about it. Warren and her dad had talked about it, and they kind of joked about it and whatever. No one knew it was going to evolve into this. And so what had happened, and all of this happened, and it was always denied. I mean, haven't read the book or don't know the story, but she ended up, what happened was, together they had my mom, and everything was fine, and Warren had taken care of my mom and made sure my grandmother had money and took care of her, helped with her rent, helped with raising his daughter, and this went on for quite a while. And then when he died, his sudden death, he was supposed to have taken care of her, and I think somewhere something went awry there on that train trip. because he had told my grandmother that he was meeting, have his attorney was going to meet the train, and they were going to work it out on paper and have her taken care of. But that never materialized. He died suddenly, and no one could find it. So she had approached the family with help because she had his daughter, and she wanted help raising her and making sure that she had a nice life and whatever. And the family actually, after he died, that the sister had paid for quite a while. She had given her money and helped her along the way because she knew that that was his daughter, because it was a denial by the family. So this went on for quite a while, and she had helped, and then all of a sudden the men in the family came and said, you can't do this. This shows guilt, and this showed that it's what it is. And so they put a stop to it. And she had even gotten help from his Secret Service agent, had helped her, and quite a few other people in the government. He had kind of rallied up to give her a hand once in a while. So a lot of people did pitch in and help her, and it was going okay, but then things got a little worse. And so she ended up having a sit-down with the family, with his brother and the wife, and which she knew. They all knew each other. And actually, his sister was my grandmother's mentor. She just loved her. She was her teacher and taught her how to write and worked with her, and they were very close. And so she helped after all this, after his death. She helped for quite a while. But then they put the kibosh on it, so it just kind of went away. Well, my grandmother was looking for help, so she approached the family and had a sit-down meeting with them, and they told her that there's no way it could be. He had polio, he had this, he couldn't do it, he was infertile, and all of these things they used and threw at her and said it was no good. And she kept asking for help, and she said, this is all I want, just enough to take care of her and give her an education and help her out. And they just kept refusing and refusing. And so it came down to the point of the, and what had happened was she was very intelligent and very organized, and she kept notes on everything, all the things they did together, everything. Well, she had to sit down for the, because she took them to court, and she had to go to court with this case on this, and it ended up that she had to prove all of this stuff for other reasons. And so she had got together all the paperwork and got all of her notes together, and that, after that she realized, well, I should just write a book, and the book would help pay for my daughter. So the family just kind of called her bluff, and she wrote the book, and that's how the book became.
And so, all these years pass. Your grandmother lives to a ripe old age, and she passes away in the late 80s. And your mother passed away in the
2000s. 95.
Yeah.
2005. Yeah, sorry, yeah.
2005. And then here comes 2015, because at that point it was still heavily denied that your mother was the daughter. What happened in 2015?
Well, what happened was, for years, what had happened was, I moved my mom in with me the last 3 years of her life. And it was something I felt I had. It's something that, you know, when you're growing up, you never think about this. You never think you would do it. I never thought I had it in me to do it. But I had put her in not a home, but it was a place. She loved bridge. I mean, she looked forward to bridge every day. That was her big thing. And so my dad and my mom went around. They belonged to bridge club. They played all the time. And so we tried to find a place for her that had bridge, and we did find a place finally where she could rent a little apartment, a little one-bedroom apartment. It was right by all of us, and they had bridge 3 nights a week. So we put her in there, and everything was fine in the beginning, and then she started going off kind of on dementia, and we could see it coming. And she started calling me. She would call me at 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock, and she had a front window, a big picture window in the front of her apartment that looked out to the street, and she would call me, and I could just hear it in her voice. She was scared. She looked out the window and saw someone, and she thought they were coming for her. Now, and you have to remember that it didn't dawn on me till later that her life was like this growing up, because they were followed all the time. They had people that had broke into their apartment to try to get information and take things from them to prove the cases and whatever. And actually, Harding's wife had hired a detective to go in there and to prove that they were having an affair and whatever. So, and they knew this. My grandmother used to tell me these stories all the time. They'd go in and there was things missing, and she knew what they were. Like I said, she knew everything. I have all of her stuff in it. There's nothing missing. I mean, every day is accounted for. It's unbelievable. And so she had knew this was going on. My mom grew up with this in her whole life, and then us three boys, as we were growing up, it was always a worry with them. They always had told us, you know, be careful where you go. They were always worried about being kidnapped or whatever and stuff like that. So we always had that on our mind. So this probably is what fed a lot of this. And so she would call me up scared to death, and I could hear it in her voice and everything, and she'd want me to come, and I'd get up and go over there. And it just, every month it kept getting worse. And then she was calling and saying that there was someone in her apartment, and she knew it. And she had bad eyes, and we used to think she's just seeing light movement or whatever. And so I would still go over there, and there'd be no one there. But she'd call up and say, they're here, I know it, I can hear them, I can feel them, and this and that. And so finally I said, you know, I can't let her live like this. It's just not right. I mean, she took care of me my whole life, raised me, gave me everything, did everything for me, and it was time for payback. And so I brought her into my house, and it was just my son and I at the time. And I brought her in to live with me and take care of her, and I did it. It's the best 3 years of my life. I would never give it up. I would do it again 100 times, and it was so rewarding. But I realized that she's just a grown-up, but she's really just a little scared girl. And we watched her for a while, and she just kind of started going backwards and doing stuff. But it made me feel so good. But the kicker is when we went and moved her out, she had a lot of things from her mother, vases and stuff, that were very valuable. And when we went and moved her out, we noticed that a lot of them were missing. And they were up on upper shelves on display, and we never noticed it at the time, but when we went and moved her, there was a lot of stuff. So we talk about it now. She was probably right, and someone was probably in there and were taking things. So it all worked out for the best. But it worked out good because my mom, my son, and I were in feeding her one night, and she had died in my arms. And I just feel so thankful for that, because that's something that all of us probably think it would be so nice to be with family and to be in that situation and be comforted like that and know that you're right there with someone, you know, other than, you know, being out somewhere by yourself or something. I just felt so good to give her that at the end.
Absolutely.
And so anyway, I'm sorry, I get off on that. So I get off track. So what had happened was, after that, I read the book again, and I started researching and doing more stuff, and I made a promise to myself that I was going to correct all this and do this for her and my grandmother, because my grandmother was wonderful. She was the most wonderful woman, and she had told us stories growing up, and her and I used to talk about it all the time, and she told us what was going on and what it was like for him and everything, and I wanted to do this for her. So I decided to start looking in the Hardings, and I started researching them and looking them up, and I don't know if anybody will get this, but I looked up a few of them, and they looked like someone that I would never be able to talk with, or they just looked on like they were on a different level with me and would not be understanding and would have that attitude. And so I just kept searching around, and all of a sudden my older brother tells me, oh, somebody called for you like 6 months ago, and he never told me. And he said that, I said, well, who was it? He said, Peter Harding. And he said, he's been looking for you. So I said, well, give me the number. And I called him the next day, and we just hit it off. And he's down to earth. I mean, he's way down to earth. And he called me and told me he read the book, and he said, anybody that does not believe this story after reading the book doesn't know what they're reading. And he said, I could tell the minute I read it that this was a love story and that everything she said was the truth and it all made sense. And he said, I feel terrible for what my family has done. I want to do something with you, and let's get this figured out. And so we said, fine, I'm all for it. And we did it originally with some company that only came up with an 86%, and they had told us they would not go public unless it was over 92% or something. So we kind of let it go. We got kind of discouraged. And then after a while, my cousin called Abby, and she had joined, it's his cousin, but it's my cousin now too, and she's the daughter of the sister. And so she called us up and said, hey, I'm on this Ancestry.com, and they've got a new process, and they are really good about it. Why don't you guys throw your names in? So Peter and I talked, and he said, look, you throw yours in first, and we'll figure it out. So we called him up and said, we're not going to tell you. I called him up, and I said, I'm not going to tell you who I am. I didn't want to have any bias or anything or them try to make it work. You know, I wanted them to come up with it completely on their own. I said, I'm just going to tell you my name, but we need this done as quick as possible. Could you run this through and do this for us in a rush? And they said, yeah, no problem. And they ran it through and real quick. And they wrote back, and we had a 99.3% match. Mm. And so that right there was our celebration day. And then Peter thought, well, you know what, I'll throw mine in just to add to the, you know, add some more cement to the mix. And so he sent his in, and right away, same match. So we knew that was it right there.
Now, the story's interesting because your mother had passed away and your grandmother had passed away, but how did the DNA match come from your mother?
They did it with well, the first one we did, the very first test we did with that company that came up with the 86%, we used a piece of her hair out of the brush, out of her hairbrush that I had. I still had a bunch of her stuff, and I pulled a piece of hair out of that. And then they did that with Peter. I think that's what we used, or Peter and I did it, and they also had the brush. And that's where they came up with these 86%. And then for the other one, what they did now, what happened is they come up with this new process where they can take it all the way back. And so they just swabbed us.
Hmm.
They swab your mouth, and we put it in little containers and sent them in.
You know, Jim, this is fascinating because this all came to light more than 3 years ago now. What right. has been the reception from the Harding family now that 3 years have passed?
Okay, well, there's two Harding families. There's the acceptable side and the unacceptable side. And the acceptable side is wonderful. It's great. It has been wonderful. We had a get-together. We called it a union, and all of his family. Peter lives in Big Sur, California. And what we did was we had everybody from the Hardings that were participating in this and wanted to be a part of this. They all flew in. It was great. There was like 15, 20 people came in. They flew in from all around the country. And I flew down. I drove down with my brother, my older brother. We went down, and we spent 3-4 days together. It was wonderful. I met cousins that I never knew I had. It's been nice. And Peter and I have a great relationship. We're close. We talk all the time. I've been down to see him quite a few times. I'm going down actually in probably a month or so again to see him. He had just actually what happened. The saddest part of the whole thing was when we had our union and everyone was celebrating. His wife was in the house and he was losing her, and she died just the day after I think that we had our get together. And she was a big part of this. She really pushed for this and helped us put it together and do everything. So it was really a loss. But it was great, and I actually had that party was before we did this. We actually, before when we came out in the paper, we came out on the New York Times. We had put it off for quite a while because we were trying to figure out with Ancestry how to approach it and go public with it, and we didn't want to do it too soon. We wanted to sit and think about it and make sure everything was okay, and we finally decided the best way to go was the New York Times, because they talked about 60 Minutes, but a lot of people don't watch that and wouldn't see as many as the New York Times. So we went with the New York Times, which really everybody sees that, and then it goes from there to everybody else.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, and that just opened the door for everything. I get responses from people all the time. I have people that call me, and it's been nice. Of course, you get the once in a while the oddballs, but more than not, you get nice responses. And the book sales went through the roof. It's out now in a little paperback, and the book sales for them went crazy, and people read it. It actually got, you can't hold me this, but it's like 1.8 or 1.2 billion hits on the story.
It's fascinating. It's amazing that
that's what we said. I mean, Yeah, the people, even the people in the news business are going, holy Christ, this is unheard of. Yeah,
absolutely.
But it's a great story, and it's a good love story, and you know, I understand. People say, well, he's married. Yeah, he was, but it's still a love story because, as we all know, we've all been in this situation. There's things that happen. People change directions, and things happen, and all I know is that they loved each other, and they were. I think they really wanted to put a life together, and I had told you this before. I think there's been foul play somewhere along the line, but we'll see what happens. But well, anyway, it's just been great. Everything, the parties are nice. The one I was going to say, people that don't want anything to do with this on the Harding side, the head of the group, he flew out to see me. And very nice. He was very nice and polite, and we got along fine. But his message was really, don't do this, when we were going to post it in the New York Times. They were so against that. They didn't want that coming out. And, but, you know, obviously we didn't listen. But that was really the whole purpose of the trip, was to talk me out of doing this.
Do you remember who it was and what his reasoning was for not bringing it up?
Yeah, he does not. The phrase is, don't trumpet this. And they say Harding's taken such a hard hit, and he's done this, and he's had this, and it's been bad, and we want to try to bring him back. Well, there's been so much good stuff about him out now. I mean, now you start researching, and I've had so many people call me that have researched him that are people that's what they do, and they say there's so much about him that no one knows. There's so many things. And actually, before I leave, I want to leave you and your listeners with something. I want, if you want to take 5 minutes to go on Google and look something up, because I think if you have people that are Harding fans and your fans, whatever, would appreciate this, what I'm going to show you, because it's something that he got a bad rap. And you know, you get older and you realize, you know, they're talking about, oh, they, T-Bot, don't be, he had nothing to do with that, nothing whatsoever. And it's like a CEO running a big, huge company, and the guy at the very bottom of the totem pole goes on, he doesn't know what the guy's doing. I mean, you know, it's like, I know you're supposed to, but reality is you can't. And these things happen, and these weren't even really people he appointed. So it's just good, you know, it's good research, really. It's a very interesting story. It's a wonderful story. Everybody calls and says, God, it's an incredible story, and it is. So it's been enjoyable.
Yeah, well, and Jim, we have about 18 minutes here, and here's what I want to cover, because, you know, we're in Marion here. We're in a 10-mile radius where I could go to the home or to the memorial where he's buried.
Right.
And there's construction right now going on at the home. They're trying, I think this week we got word they were 83 or 87% of the way to building this museum in 2020 on the 100th anniversary of his election.
Right.
Has anybody contacted you, or have you contacted? Yeah. Oh, well, there
nope.
We go.
Nothing. And this is, well, things are going to change. I'll be seeing you. I'm going to be popping in on you pretty quick. So keep your eyes peeled.
Well, but, I hope you give us a heads up.
Something has to happen here. This is terrible. I mean, they just, I'll tell you in private some of the things that are going on, but I'm just, it's ridiculous. I mean, they call me, the Hardings on my side of the Hardings, they've called me, did you get this? Did you get that? No, I haven't gotten anything. And they all get it, see? And it's really funny, because I should send you this, and you could post it maybe some on your site or something, but I should send you the chart. They sent me the chart from the DNA, and it shows me as, I think it's 32 or 35% of his DNA, and it shows the rest of these guys down at 2 and 3%, 5%. And it just shows you the unbalance here. It's just like, it's unbelievable.
It certainly, and I hope you give us a heads up so we will know you're coming. But Jim...
That would ruin the surprise.
Well, I wouldn't tell anybody when you were coming. I would be glad to have you come into the studio and visit with us for a while.
Of course, that's my plan. You'd be my first stop.
Oh, perfect. Well, as long as we have that, then I'm good. Jim, a couple things I want to talk about, because I think it's important to note that Warren Harding was president March 4th, 1921 to August 2nd, 1923. Your mother was born October 22nd, 1919. She was born before he was president. I think people lose that in the mix sometimes. And so you had said earlier, and I don't think we had talked about this. Now, he had given your grandmother money?
Oh, sure. The whole time.
Oh, okay.
He'd always supported her. And you know what it is? And she had told us this, and I understand this. He originally, when she became pregnant, he asked her, would you be up for, what is your choice? And would you want to have an abortion? Would you want to do this? Would you want to do that? And she said, no. And so they discussed it, and she just said flat, said, no, I'm not going to do that. And you know what's funny is, and my grandmother, if she's here, she'd tell you, she's blowing the pace. He wanted kids. That was his dream. He loved kids. And that's the whole joke of it. I mean, this is what he was wanted his whole adult life. He looked so forward to having a child. And so she kind of said no, and he said fine. And this is what I tell people. People will say, well, you know, this and that and this. Well, all these other guys in his position that have done this have done something to move the people away, or, you know, have them go away or do something else or shut them up and give them a bunch of money. And he didn't. He took care of her week after week. He took care of her. His Secret Service agent, she was real close with him. And he would give him money, and he would take it over to her. If you read the book, and the second book even, she wrote a second book. And it tells why she wrote the book and how she wrote it, what she went through to write it. And it's really interesting. But he would send money over to her with his Secret Service agent. And he paid her rent. He put her in a place. When she had my mom, he put her in a place in, oh, Christ, my memory is just terrible. But he put her in a nice place to live. And he had a lady living with her that's a midwife and everything. I mean, he gave her the best of everything and took care of her completely. And originally he had told her that he was going to set up a trust fund for my mom for $50,000 that would be used for her education later in life and to take care of her and give her a start. And that's what he had told my grandmother that he was going to do, and that his attorney was coming on, and they were writing this up. They'd already talked about it, and it would be done. And do that, and that's what I think that was his plan was. So it just makes sense. I mean, he took care of her the whole time. He never stopped until his death, and that was that. And then she was getting it from a few of the people inside that, and then getting it from his sister. And it went on for a while, and then it stopped, and she kind of panicked because, and she, you know, she had to give up her daughter because of all the tension over the book and everything else. A few years later, she put my daughter in the custody of her sister, which meant she was still in the family, and she had her still, and whatever. I have all the letters she wrote to the adoption agency, to the state, for transferring the daughter from her, out of her custody into my aunt, and then back into her. And I have the letters she wrote to the attorney or the judge asking to put her back into her name, and about their life and how much she loved her. I mean, it's interesting. I have all these things that she had done throughout her life. It's just to read it's so interesting.
Yeah.
And you know what's really interesting about it is the way people talked to each other back then. It was so different. They were respectful and kind, and it's interesting.
Now, because this is the commemoration 95 years ago today, President Harding did die. Your mother would have been nearly 4 years old. What do you think happened on this day? And what did your grandmother think happened 95 years ago?
My grandmother was gone. So, and then this takes us back to him taking care of her. When he went on the train trip, he asked my grandmother what she wanted to do, and she wanted to go abroad. She wanted to be a writer. She wanted to go abroad, and she wanted to go to school. And he said, I'll do what you want to do, wherever you want to go, to help with anything you want to do. So he sent her to, I think, France. I have her passport and everything. And it's funny because I watched a TV show one day, and my mom was at home, and she used to do this all the time. She'd call me up and say, Jim, turn on Channel 6. You won't believe what they're talking about. and you won't believe what they're saying. And so I turn it on, and it would be somebody there. They were interviewing about my grandmother and Hardy. And these people would be on there, and I'd stay on the phone with her, and we'd be talking, and she'd say, look at this fool. And one of them was John Dean, and he had wrote a book, and he's making a statement about how my grandmother had said she'd been to France and all these places and done all these things, and she had never done there. She was lying about that. Why wouldn't she be lying about the rest of this? And she never went to these places. And my mom said, what is he talking? He knows nothing about what he's talking about. And I have the passport with both of their pictures in it, with the date stamped, everything. It's just unbelievable. It's just mind-boggling that, and this is what it was like for them all the time. They just were always, people were talking about what a terrible person she was and how awful she was, and she was the kindest, sweetest woman you would ever meet. She would not tell a lie. You could offer $1 million, and she would not tell a lie. I think I told this story to you before, but in case nobody's heard this, when I was in high school, and you know how it is with your grandmother, they'll do anything for you. And I cut school, and my grandmother lived right next to the school. So I would walk over there and hang out with her for a few hours. You know, I'd go and she'd make me lunch, and I'd hang out with her all the time. I'd just cut a class and go over there. Well, so one day, I'm sitting there watching TV, eating my sandwich, and the phone rings. And I can hear her, and she says, uh-huh, yes, this is her. And I'm thinking, what's this about? And so all of a sudden she says, oh, yes, of course. And I realized it's probably the school. And I'm waving her off. And she's going, of course he's here. Yes, Jim's fine. He's here right now. And she turned me in. And I'm thinking, I told her, Grandma, how can you do that? You know, and she said, I don't lie. I'm not going to lie for this. You're here. And I told him you were here. And this is, she turned in her own grandson. So, and that was her big thing, was teaching us not to lie. And to do the right thing.
So,
she was very adamant about that. She, her family, all of them were the same way. She had two sisters, and they were wonderful.
What was her idea of what happened 95 years ago today?
Oh, it was awful. I'm sorry. She was over there. He had sent her over there. She was going to school, and she was over there, and she was following it through the paper, what was going on. And all of a sudden, she walked by his owner. She heard someone say something about it, and she ran to the little store and got and saw the paper, and she was devastated. She said that was the worst time of her life. Well, you can imagine that, being in love with someone like that, having their child, and all of a sudden you're this far away from them. Like she said, I could not touch him. She tells her there was no way to be there for him, and she found that she was just devastated, and she came home right away.
She thought that there was foul play.
Oh yes, she always told us that.
Now
she told us there's always.
Did she ever meet Florence Harding being around the president?
Did who? My grandma?
Yeah.
My mom?
Your grandmother?
No, she never did.
Never did. Did your grandmother think it was Florence who had instituted the foul play?
Was warned at
did your grandmother think that Florence was the one who had did him in?
No. She had told us growing up all the time, my brother and I just talked about this the other day, that he was afraid of his wife, and he always felt that if she found out, she would do something. And I agree. And now I've kind of read some stuff. You know what's weird? We've all grown up, we're all adults now. I think anybody over 12 that researched this would figure this out, kind of. But if you look and start researching it now, if you know the story, you know that the minute he died, she started burning everything and would not, she had him embalmed right away. They couldn't do anything. They couldn't test him, nothing. They couldn't check anything for anything. That's pretty odd.
Is it of a belief that Florence killed her husband? Is that the thought, that she might have done this?
You mean Florence?
Yeah. That she.
Yeah, I think I honestly think that she. It was a slow poison, and that's what she did. And he had some problems, but I know you probably don't think the same way I do, but it just kind of makes sense as you look at it. And, I mean, what purpose would there be in not letting anybody look at him. I mean, he's the president of the United States. You're not allowed to do that anyway. And they went right back to the house and had everything brought over and burned every paper. They went through every piece of paper he had and burned everything.
You know, it's interesting.
I mean,
it's interesting, Jim, because it's a fascinating story. We were talking about that this morning here at the station. And one of the things that is interesting is that we all know about Carrie Phillips because of letters that she was supposed to burn
right.
that she did not, that she held on to.
Right.
So people were very aware that that affair did happen. And one of the reasons that your grandmother, I think, was put off for so long was, at least by the media, was that there was no letters or anything of that. Was anything ever found of your grandmother's that was a correspondence? Did she ever talk about letters or things of that nature that she had of the president's?
Yeah, well, she got a letter that he had sent to a company, a steel company, to try to get her a job and representing her and whatever. But you know what? It's like I talk to people now, and if you look at my this will solve the whole thing for you. Everybody at that reunion, just about all the women at that reunion, when we got together as family, they all told me I had something to me. Even the men, I am so sorry that our family did what they did to you and treat you the way they do. We are so sorry. We do not feel that way at all. And all the women said, you know, just so you know, all the women in the family back then knew that that was his daughter.
Hmm. So everybody was
that
aware.
Most of them, the majority of them felt that that was his daughter. And there was no question about it. But it was the men. And we're coming from a time when women weren't allowed to speak their minds and say what they wanted to say. And like Peter said, those families were run strict and he's sure that they weren't allowed to. I mean, he had the president's daughter in his bookshelf growing up, and it was never open. His dad told him he read it and it was all lies, and nobody was allowed to read the book. And that's what's so funny to Peter. He says, you know, once my dad was gone and I started realizing all of this stuff and started seeing this about her, he said, I went and took that book out and read it. And he said, but what's funny is when I opened the book, it had never been opened. I could tell it was never read. And he said, so my dad lied to me. And he said, once I read that book, I thought, how could anybody not know this? He said, this story just cries of love and truth. He said, it's completely a woman's side of the story that's completely true. He said, I know that. And he's a psychologist. So he said, how could you not know this? And all the women said, oh, the women in the family knew that that was his daughter. I mean, she looks just like him. Well, now we know, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but that's true.
They just wanted to stump it. That's the whole thing. Like Peter says, that the other side of the family does not want to stop their parade, and you know, they're the ones that get involved in everything and do everything, so this will kind of hinder them, and that's one of their biggest things. And if anything, you know, this proves he's a man, and it proved that he was a loving man, and. And I don't see, you know, there's so many good things about him that I don't understand it at all. So,
well,
I just kind of.
Yeah, no, it's you know, there had been talk that obviously the two had exchanged letters. Did your grandmother say what?
They had tons of letters.
Yeah,
I think I told you this last time we talked. I'm sure I probably threw a couple away and didn't even know it. But that's my grandmother. So, and this takes us to this will take us right now to the Trump era, which I can connect a lot of this stuff to this. So, my grandmother had an affair with him. And they sat down together and decided, and he was afraid of his wife, number one. She told me he used to say that all the time. He used to say, I have such a fear of my wife. And if you read about her now and read, and you're going to read if you do what I ask you to do, you'll see a lot of these things that she wrote, talking about how she ran him and made him who he is and had to watch him because he was a bumbling fool, couldn't do anything on his own. Well, crap, he's the smartest guy around. So he just played stupid and worked it all out. So, but anyway, they decided between them that they would burn their papers. And so that's the thing. That's love. That shows love. And so she burned those papers because that's what he asked her to do, and that's the agreement they made. And she sticks by, she says. So she burned the papers out of respect for them and their agreement and that they, because of their relationship. So now you come to Trump, or anybody actually, you come to all these, or Carrie Phillips is the same thing. So these people had affair with power, these women had affairs with powerful women, but they kept all the papers. Carrie Phillips kept every letter. That's because she was planning on using them sometimes later, and which is what she did. So that tells you there's no love there. If she loved him, she would do what he asked her to do. That's what you do for love. And you would respect that as part of your relationship. So I see that as a distinguishing fact between my mother and Carrie and anybody else. It's like all these people now, that these women that are coming out, well, they're not anymore, they're backing off, but came out about Trump, but they keep everything. Well, I've got this, I've got that, I've got this. Well, why would you keep that over somebody that you haven't seen in 10 years or whatever, that you really only had a one-day fling with or whatever? So people keep this stuff planning on using it later and making money on it or something. So I just look at that as a sign that of how much she cared about him and respected him to do what they had agreed upon.
Nan Britton, your grandmother, obviously knew him very well. Now, that's an interesting perspective that she said that he told her that he was scared of his wife. What did she say as far as the kind of person he was, aside from being afraid of his wife? What kind of gentleman was he? I mean, he obviously had some other picadillos with women, but what was his character? What was his personality? What was his presidency? She was there for it.
Think about if you have an affair with someone, you tell them everything. You open up and you tell them things that you wouldn't tell somebody else. And he told her everything. She told me he was the most wonderful man. He cared about people. He wanted to help people. And if you look at some of the things he put in and did, he did. And it was all about women. He wanted women to have the votes. He really respected women, and he loved women, obviously. And she said he was very romantic. Even in the letters, they are so romantic, the stuff he writes. But he cared about everybody. He cared about the little people and wanted to help everybody. She said that was his biggest thing, was making things better for everybody and trying to do the right thing by everybody. And she said he was a straight shooter, a right on the money guy, and always treated her like gold. I mean, she, to the day she died, was in love with him, and she could not say anything bad about him. And she would tell us, I cannot think of anything bad to say about him.
Jim, let me ask you, I want to ask you this before I go, because we could talk forever, and I can't wait till you come to town, but your grandmother didn't pass away until 1991. Now, this is long after the Carrie Phillips letters came to light in the 50s. Did your grandmother know about Carrie Phillips? Did she ever speak of that?
Yes. Oh, she knew about him then, because everyone in the neighborhood knew about it. Everyone in the neighborhood kind of knew about this. Well, you know, I don't know how much. I'm sure you know about this stuff. You know, the whole theory is she was a spy.
Right, German spy.
Her and her husband were spies. And the thing is, it's kind of weird because it's highly likely. But that was the whole thing, was to get him in there. And she did. My grandmother told me, and I read this in the book, or one of the books, that she did. She was always trying to push him to appoint somebody or put something in or do something. And she kept telling him about the war or something. She wanted him to pull out or something, and he didn't, or he wasn't listening to her on a lot of things. But she always was throwing opinions at him and what he should do and not do. Now, my grandmother did push him on the thing, and she kept telling him he was right, women's vote. And that's what he wanted. He wanted the woman's vote.
You know, I'll tell you what's interesting, Jim. Recently we learned that during the election, which obviously he had already been with your grandmother and also been with Carrie Phillips, but during the election, because Carrie still lived here in Marion, during the presidential election of 1920, he sent Carrie Phillips on a trip around the world during election time.
Right.
So it's kind of...
No, he didn't.
He didn't.
The Republican Party did, not him.
Right, the Republican Party did. Right.
Yeah.
So was
he wasn't up on that.
Was the Republican Party aware of your grandmother and your mother?
Oh yeah, they had hired people to go in the house and spy on them. Yes, but I'm sure he told everybody she was, hands off.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I tell you, Jim, to have you on today is the only person I would have wanted to have on this 95th commemoration day, and I can't wait to see you in person, and I always thank you for your kindnesses, because like it...
I appreciate this, and I thank you immensely.
Yeah.
So right before you cut me off, can I ask you to look something up?
Oh, yeah, go right ahead. Go right ahead.
Okay, and I want you, I want people to look this up and understand what I'm saying here, because I sit and watch my grandfather do everything else, and I want people to read this and think, where have I heard this before? I'm going to give you a start of it, and this is written very eloquent. This is written like him, because he writes unbelievable, and this is written by him, and just remember as you read this, this was written in 1922 or 23 or whatever. It was during his time. And just read this. I'll give you the start of it, and then I want you to, you can go online and look up his famous quotes, or just look up under pictures on Google, and there's a thing of this. But it starts out, in the great fulfillment, we must have a citizenship less, and that's it. I'm going to give you that. Look that up, and just look at all of his quotes and read that. And then you tell me where you heard it before, and you will be shocked. But this will put a light on my grandfather.
In the great fulfillment of citizenship, is that correct?
No, in the great fulfillment, we must have a citizenship, and that's it.
We must have a citizenship. All right. Jim Blessing,
okay,
the grandson.
Okay, have your viewers look that up, and especially ones that are fans of President Harding's, because I think it'll make them feel good in their heart to know that this thing has gone, because it's the same saying, but you have to just... So just look this up, and you know what? If you don't mind, write me back and tell me what you think.
I will do that. Jim Blessing, the grandson of President Warren Harding, without question. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much, and thanks to everybody else.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, what a day. This is Scott Spears headed for the dugout.
A collaboration that may have you seeing Kosai in a whole new way as well.
This is Scott Spears looking down on the beautiful city of WWGH's Chopper. If you would like to